Welcome to The Gauge, a new podcast brought to you by Greengage, the first fully integrated financial services group, bridging the traditional financial services space with the new digital innovations in crypto assets and blockchain. In this series, we gauge expert opinion on the latest tech trends and plan to bring you a measured approach to discussing key developments in the world of blockchain and digital assets. Your host today is Greengage's CEO, Sean Kiernan, who is in conversation with Olaf Ransom, otherwise known as the Banker's Plumber. Olaf has been in financial services for some 35 years, naturally the vast majority of that time in what we might call TradFi or traditional finance. More recently, Olaf has been involved in the fintech or DeFi world, helping the industry prepare for the new era of digital assets. For the last 13 years, he has worked as an independent consultant. He helped establish Finality, the industry consortium working to set up a new means of payment on-chain. Most recently, he worked with SDX, the Swiss digital exchange, the world's first regulated exchange and CSD. Sean and Olaf will discuss what sort of plumbing is required for banking to become fully decentralized, how will the role of the custodian shift, and more broadly, how can the new world of banking brought about by blockchain and digital assets coexist with more traditional ways of doing things?
Olaf, delighted to have you join the Gauge podcast. I think it's very exciting to have the Banker's Plumber with us today. It would be great if you wouldn't mind just introducing yourself in a few words for our guests.
Yeah, thanks, Sean. And thank you for having me and for getting this organized. The Banker's Plumber, that's a moniker that dates back, I think, nearly 20 years to a conversation at Cybos in San Francisco and with some friends from Capco. So I said, you're really like the Banker's Plumber putting this stuff together, and that kind of stuck. So I'm a TradFi guy, I suppose, who's helping those in the fintech, DeFi, new world, whatever you want to call it, deal with how do you integrate the new with the old? And that is a question which occupies an awful lot of my time. So most of the career spent in tier one investment banks, from the old Salomon Brothers to Goldman to Credit Suisse, in various functions, from transaction banking, settlements in CLS, in foreign exchange, to prime brokerage, and then the last dozen years consulting on my own, doing various projects around the world for large banks, whether that's been introducing CLS settlement, liquidity related work, data reporting, more recently things in the fintech world, particularly means of payment, CBDC or its equivalent, and more recently with SDX, the Swiss digital exchange here in Switzerland, is the first regulated trading venue and CSD.
Fantastic. It's quite a varied background. I also enjoy that we have a few people in common that have crossed our mutual paths. So a really warm welcome. A lot of people have been speaking about DeFi or decentralized finance, and I would just be curious for your thoughts, being the Banker's Plumber, on the idea of the plumbing of banking, and what is the necessary plumbing required for banking to become fully decentralized, if it should be decentralized.
I think you can change some of the things. The hardest part of what you can see going on around digital assets, particularly cryptocurrencies, is that you have to make that work in parallel with the existing infrastructure. So if we take the world that you knew it in previous days, working for the London arm of a Swiss bank, those Swiss banks have got all their processing for foreign exchange, for currencies, for payments, for securities, and so on. And then along come these digital assets. And the first of those things you've got to be willing to deal with is crypto, not because you may or may not believe in blockchain as the new, Bitcoin rather as the new gold, or Ether as the new gold, whichever, but just simply, particularly in that private banking world that you're familiar with, people are going to go, hey, we want to put a couple of percent of the assets into that asset class. And as soon as it's a couple of percent of the assets into that asset class, you're by definition going to have to exist in parallel with the existing infrastructure. Sometimes that's very frustrating for all the new fintech people who say, why is it so difficult to integrate that in the old infrastructure? And sometimes, of course, it's frustrating for the people with the traditional infrastructure who need to find a way to shoehorn that in. So we've got this coexistence, and that is definitely going to occupy the banks dramatically as they try to make those things go together. Will we go fully decentralized? I don't think so. If decentralized is permissionless markets, I don't think you're going to see that. I think we will err on the side of having permissioned activity, even if that ends up on the public blockchain. So I don't think we'll be as radical, perhaps, as some folk would have it, that we just throw everything out. Clearly, there are issues with all these things we've set up in recent years, sanction screening, anti-money laundering, and so on. And we're going to have to replicate that set of controls. Although ironically, and I was watching an interview with Senator Warren in the States, who was trying to say that the whole blockchain stuff made all this stuff harder. It doesn't actually. Blockchain is super easy to follow the trail of what went where. But you don't know who necessarily owns that wallet, where the stuff ended up. But you can watch where it goes. So I think we will have those decentralized assets in some shape or form, starting with cryptocurrencies. But we won't get rid of some of these established controls that we have around the setup we currently have.
It's interesting how you frame the merging, perhaps, or the speaking of the centralized and the decentralized worlds around product. In the context of maybe crypto being a way in for traditional banks, where clients request exposure for an asset class and then banks have to respond. Do you think there's other ways for banks to engage with decentralized finance or decentralization other than a product-led strategy?
You could create some form of new marketplaces. So, and I have been trying over the last couple of months to get my head around the DeFi part of all this fintech. And you see all these new DeFi places where trading activity takes place automatically. And I've been trying my best to understand it. We're definitely at the outer edges of what I can get my head around being a TradFi guy. But as I looked at it, I thought, what this looks to me like is a change from when I was at Goldman Sachs. I did a lot of work with the equity derivatives guys. So they sat at their desk, had some very clever people with some very powerful computers doing lots of algo trading. And the algo would sit on the trader's desk and communicate with lots of places and do trades. And as I looked at DeFi, I thought, this looks to me like you can create a place and say, at this place, you can trade this pair of assets. And it's almost like you take that algo and you move it to that new place and let the machine do its thing. I thought, okay, I could get that. I just about understand algo trading. I could understand that there could be some marketplaces with some very specialized activity and you can go and interact. But then if you look at these DeFi things, I'm a controls guy. And as all this DeFi stuff came up, I said, you people doing DeFi, answer me something. Who's the operator of the system? And which judge do I go and see when it all goes wrong? Because if you think, now you think of my friends at Goldman who used to have their algos, they've got a thing on their desk called the kill switch. And they hit it, and all those instructions get deleted. There's a reasonable amount of control. And they know to whom they've sent them. And if it doesn't go right, they're going to call up the operator of MTFX and go, hey, problem. And you can see in DeFi that these things aren't yet given. If though we could create an environment where there are some regulated places to play in DeFi that say, yeah, we know who the operator is, we know which judge we're going to go see if anything goes wrong, I could quite see banks changing the way they do business and trading, and that would equally apply to some of the buy side to say, hey, there are now some very specialist places you can go and trade, but it's very clear who's operating it, who the judge is, who the members are, and so on. There are criteria for that. So that works quite well. So I could see that kind of evolution, but with every emphasis, I don't think I've really, really understood DeFi yet.
I think it's, again, an interesting perspective. We've heard often of DeFi as it's currently constructed to be described as if it's in the Napster phase, if you will.
Yes.
And people are waiting for the Spotify to emerge. I think behind all this, as you rightly say, there's a question around where is their finger to point in case things go wrong? And does that mean it's a walled garden approach or something else that we haven't thought through to protect and have somebody centralized vetting who comes on to a platform to engage? And I think one fundamental question behind that then is where do the assets sit? Where is the custody? We've seen that digital custody has changed, and I'd be keen to hear your thoughts.
Yeah. So I think as all of these things emerge, and I was having this conversation with my colleagues at STX about half an hour ago, you end up with three things. You end up with execution venues, asset custody, and the means of payment. And those three things are not necessarily in one place anymore. So if I use a simple example, I've got many good friends at Fireblocks, who are the leading custody provider. They'll tell you they've got, I don't know, let's pick eight. Last time I talked to them, it's probably 800 clients. Even if all of those 800 clients bought a cloud service and they all were using the same particular clouds separated for security reasons and all the rest, the only thing they've really got in common is they've all bought something from Fireblocks. But they're all mutually exclusive and collectively exhaustive. Whereas I'm coming from a world where people go ultimately to a CSD, a central securities depository, or an ICSD if it's Euroclear or Clearstream. Euroclear or even SDX or SIX apparent, they're operating a CSD. They've got a bunch of accounts for different people, for assets and for cash. And you haven't got that in this new world. 800 people buy from Fireblocks and they haven't necessarily got anything in common. So you're going to have to deal with this decentralized asset custody. And then you've got to look and go, well, where's the means of payment? And at the moment, that could be, the answer to that could be several. One answer is, hey, many of the parties bank at Silvergate or Signature Bank in the US. You have some commercial bank as common denominator possible. That only works if you've got a common denominator. It gets a little bit better and easier if both banks have tokenized cash, because if you've got tokens for custody and tokens for means of payment, that's technically a lot easier. Or you could have stable coins. I'm no fan of stable coins, but I understand why people use stable coins today, because they're playing in a market that's really, really volatile. Bitcoin, Ether, et cetera, and the price is going up and down like crazy. And even if a stable coin has some risks, and it's some of them have more than others, that volatility is much lower. And I liken this to being an ice hockey player. If you play ice hockey, you can play for about 5 minutes and it gets about exhausting. And then you get off the ice and you go sit on the bench. If you took your skates off, when you want to get back on the ice, it's really hard because you've got to lace up all your skates. So the equivalent of that is getting rid of the crypto and taking a stable coin, irrespective of what one's particular philosophies are about stable coins, good thing, bad thing. It's just simply a way of having less risk while you sit off the ice and then you want to go play. But you could use stable coins to settle. Now, you could, and that's a very broad brush general statement, but you wouldn't if, for example, you are our friends, the Swiss banks. There is not a cat's chance in hell of a major Swiss bank putting Tether or Circle on its balance sheet because of the risk. The risk is just too high, and therefore the risk weighting, and therefore the assets that you need to back that up as capital are just too high. But you could theoretically use a stablecoin that's in there. If you get more advanced, you could use a wholesale CBDC or its equivalent provided by someone like Finality. So you string these pieces together from venues, asset custody, means of payment, but you haven't got that centralized concept that we've brought up on and we've settled a few trades using in our time. And I think that there was in one of the topics we're talking about, is there a role for the centralized securities depository? And I think that gets you to not in the way that we know it. You are not going to have everybody having their custody at one place. So, I mean, if I extend that example I used earlier, so some people use, or a lot of people use Fireblocks, some other people go and buy copper, some other people might go for different solutions. I was suddenly about to, I was going to quote one and the name escapes me in that. I should know it. We were talking to them recently, but there are all these different custody setups, but they're all discrete from one another and individually on a Fireblocks solution, they're discrete too. So you haven't got central securities depository anymore. So we're going to have to find ways to connect up execution venues, custody of assets, means of payment. Simple as that, I think, is the way to look at that. That could be a role for a CSD, a new role. And because someone's got to sit there and go, okay, execution venues, tell me about the trades that were done on your exchange. Are all the parties agreed that these are the trades we did? Yes, okay. Let's have a settlement time. If I go and talk to some of the people in the crypto game at the moment, as a plumber, I look at it and go, geez, there's nothing good about the setup you have. It has no redeeming qualities. Either you've got an exchange that says pre-fund me, so you fragment liquidity and you sacrifice best execution. Or you've got a broker who says, yeah, we'll do some trades and we'll settle at some point. There's no fixed time you have to settle. Then the broker turns around and goes, oh, yeah, of course, yes, you owe me 500,000 for 10 Bitcoin. You give me the money and I'll give you the Bitcoin. And if you're an old guy like me with gray hair, you go, that's settlement risk. We don't really like that stuff. We want to do nice DVP, delivery versus payment things. And then we'll be happy because we won't give up one asset and not get the other. But this so-called new industry is rife with old problems, which of course for old guys like me leads me to smile a little bit and go, hey, you know, it might be shiny on the outside, but underneath it's not that clever. So you can see in there a role for trying to sort out how do you do this settlement stuff properly in a sort of robust way that we have developed, particularly since Lehman. So I think if you look at our current infrastructure, we're effective. Banks largely get stuff done. We're not particularly efficient. It's incredibly expensive to be in wholesale banking. I saw some comment maybe a couple of years ago, Gary Gensler, who's now the head of the SEC, had written some article that said, cost of financial services in the States consumes about 7.5% of GDP. So if we can be more efficient, everybody benefits because it's the pension funds, it's my direct investments, it's my own. If I was in the States, 401k or ISA, if I was in the UK, et cetera. If we've got better plumbing, know, everyone will benefit. We haven't yet in and around crypto. I think the plumbing is pretty bad, actually. It's about as good as insulation is in the UK. In houses is just not particularly clever. So I think we're missing that. And I can see that evolving as we move to other forms of digital assets.
It's something that we've seen also described about fintech generally, how the front end can be very whizzy, but the back end, the plumbing, sometimes just holds it back. And I think it's interesting you mentioned two of the biggest custodians, Fireblocks and Copper, for the digital asset space. And something holding them back is the absence perhaps of a wholesale CBDC or some medium for them to plug into a government-backed rails that would give comfort to the likes of the Swiss banks or any banks really to engage. I'd be curious to hear your thoughts, because you said you're slightly kind of concerned about the existing stablecoin or environment, if the CBDC world would, if properly enfranchised, would change that opportunity for the likes of the big digital asset custodians. And I'd also be keen to hear your thoughts on the likes of the existing CSDs, the Euroclears of the world, if they might also be able to engage with the new technology in a way that would help that 7.5% of GDP issue raised by Gary Gensler, which for reference, I think in the UK is also around 7%.
Yeah, significant number. It really is worth trying to put a dent on it. I think it's the right way to look at it. Let's take those apart. So the first one, the Euroclears, they certainly can help. You've seen Clearstream work with HQLAX to improve the ability to move collateral. That's actually around, let's say, to move it. They've made it better to use it by trying not to move it specifically. But they've made that world better, and you can see Deutsche Börse, they're making an effort. Euroclear haven't yet quite seen the same effort. And the other question on CBDCs and stablecoins, what does it do? I think we will see some wholesale CBDC equivalents. So you've got the Bank of England has opened up its policy so that fintechs can have accounts with the Bank of England. So Finality in the UK is taking advantage of that. That's one part of it. The other part of it is also there's a whole bunch of access rules. Who's allowed to hold what balances in what currencies. So you can have an account at the Bank of England if you're supervised by the Bank of England. And therefore, they say, well, you can have an account in Finality if you're supervised by the Bank of England. That's not very helpful. And the reason I say it's not very helpful is if you imagine my friends down the road here at Credit Suisse, they've probably got 200 entities that operate daily. If they can all hold wholesale CBDC overnight, they can keep the settlement wheel flying around. If the Brits turn around at Threadneedle Street, oh, of course not. No, terrible, bad thing. Only those nice regulated people around the corner. That's a bit of a mess because all those other Credit Suisse entities would like to be able to keep their cash and then move it around quickly. You can imagine at the end of the day, you're taking your pounds and Swiss francs, turning them into dollars, turning them into yen, Australian dollars, Kiwi later on. And then it enables that to happen. So I think one part of it is the willingness to have the structures that would allow for a wholesale CBDC. And the Finality example shows you that it's not a requirement that the central bank themselves are the operator of the thing. The central bank sets out the controls and the guidelines and should then allow the private sector to operate. They also need to then expand the access policy. If they get that right, and that's not a technical problem, you know, that Finality can open on their infrastructure many accounts for many legal entities as long as they're within the rules. It's a willingness problem on the access side. If you had that, you get the access sorted, then we really could have a world where you can have your many execution venues, you can have your decentralized custody, coppers, Bosonic was the other one I was thinking about earlier, and the guys at Fireblocks, and you could all point at one, for any one legal entity, one pot of cash per currency. And that would really start to then make a huge difference to all the players in financial services, because all that liquidity is incredibly expensive. It's one of these things that the vast majority of people who work in banks have no clue about. I don't even think the regulators fully appreciate the costs of the things that they impose on the players either. It's a huge number, and it's a very fixed number. Once you get told that your liquidity buffers should be yay high, they're yay high until you can. It's almost like if you had a crash in your car, and the insurance company says, well, you know, we can reduce your premium when you've been driving safely for a while. To get those premiums down, you've got to show that you've improved. And that really is a sore point for a lot of people, but without necessarily a great understanding.
It's fascinating how you mentioned it's not necessarily a technical issue. It's more the access that's holding this back.
Yeah.
One of the trends I think we've seen since the financial crisis is a shifting of liability downstream to, as you mentioned, liquidity buffers and various things the banks now need to put in place to increase the robustness of not just their own balance sheet, but systemically creating enough liquidity in the system to respond coherently if some other crisis were to arise. Do you think it's possible for the access rights, as we've kind of hinted at, to be resolved by the banks or by financial sector participants? Or do you think this needs to be resolved rather at the central bank level, potentially?
This is categorically a central bank problem because it's a regulated problem, because understandably, each regulator wants to regulate, readily be able to regulate their flock. One of my friends at Finality was General Counsel Gary Chu, and he described it thus. He says they always want to know who the throat to choke is, and that then has to be somebody who's in your country. So we have this relatively narrow definition of who will let have access to the infrastructure. And this is where the banks need to, the central banks and regulators, mostly one and the same, but where they need to open that up. Really, I think there's a poor understanding of the settlement concept, that the central bankers don't really understand how the plumbing works. Cross-border, they understand their own bit, and that's fine, but they don't understand what all these restrictions impose on market participants, and that's where you get some of the issues. So it's certainly for the central banks to adjust. A suspicion here is that the Finality effort, which has got 15 global institutions involved in it, is very much on the right track. They will get their technical capability set up, but they won't get the wide access that the thing really needs. What I suspect will happen is there will be some form of gradual awakening that you need to change the access rules, but we're certainly not there yet.
It's interesting to see at an international level. There are certain jurisdictions that are perhaps more progressive than others in examining, say, CBDCs. It seems, purely anecdotally, just from what we're hearing in the market, that almost every central bank is considering in some shape or form to engage, at least at a consultation level, with the technology. Would you say that there's any particular jurisdictions that are doing it well or are more advanced? I'm curious also for your thoughts on China specifically.
Well, is anybody doing it better or worse? So they're all doing it. I suppose was my first thought. They're all doing it because they can, because they don't have a budget problem. Right? It's easy, they can just print money, so that's not particularly difficult. They all started to do it at the very latest when Libra and Facebook was an issue. I think all of them have got a broad understanding that there's a hell of a difference between retail and wholesale. I could give you some arguments for why you might do retail. If you're in somewhere like the US, which for all its bluster, as far as banking goes, they're terribly backward. And I allow myself to make that comment about any place that still uses checks. Dark ages as to what they use over there. So you can see some improvements there, or you can see some improvements if you want to make banking more readily available. That might be another reason you want to do it, or you want to use it as a better means of distributing help. I could see you being the state of New Jersey and saying, well, if we're handing out welfare, we want people to spend the money in Jersey. All of that. I can make you some retail arguments. If you're in Switzerland, pretty much none of that holds. Now, we're pretty advanced. We don't use checks anymore. We've got perfectly good payment systems. We certainly don't need retail for that. Now, there are huge policy issues to be answered around the retail side, one on the store of value and the other on, as a means of payment. The ECB was a very smart gentleman with a very capable team there called Ulrich Binsile, and he put out a paper on, actually, you shouldn't be so scared about that store of value stuff, because it's easy to say, hey, you can have a max of this much. We can have differentiated rates on different balances and so on. And then a very methodical, which I suppose you'd expect from somebody who's German, or it's an engineering-minded paper that they put out recently. And I mean, it's very complimentary. I actually went through, this stuff's not that scary. All that control stuff we can do, not necessarily as many controls as the Chinese might want to keep an eye on who's doing exactly what. That's the other end of that spectrum. You know, too much data would be a dangerous thing. The means of payment is tricky, because as the paper pointed out, well, hang on, it's a bit tricky, because if we're successful making it a good means of payment, we'll crowd out the commercial banks, which might not be a desirable result in doing that. So I think my sense is, they're all the central banks are doing stuff on CBDC. They got the money, it's cool to be doing it. And they do want to be prepared in case they needed to do it. So the Swiss proved the point with a little bit of help from some of my colleagues at SDX. They proved how they could have a CBDC set up where the Swiss National Bank would collect fiat currency and turn it into tokenized money backed by the SMB. So they've proved how that works. They know how it could go through the account. So they're at least in the position to go and say, well, could do it if we had to do it on the wholesale front. Whether they will or not remains to be seen. It feels more like wholesale will be a private sector effort. The Chinese stuff I'm not so familiar with. It seems that from what I can gather, they've made a very conscious decision to be technological leaders. That they're doing this to lead in technology and to help strengthen the use of the yuan. Some years back, I was down in South Africa frequently. I went to Victoria Falls for the weekend to Zimbabwe. Everything's Chinese there. They're this Belt and Road thing, they're using all the tools at their disposal to increase their influence. So you can understand why they might try this digital yuan. That's useful. That's not a reason for Switzerland to want to try and do a digital Swiss franc. You know, we don't we don't need to or want to. In fact, we're even prevented from constitutionally expanding our powers like that and having those influences. So I see that the Chinese one is a very deliberate, long-term strategic bet, as much about overseas influence as it might be about keeping an eye on their citizens. And having that, and it's just they've got the money. They're a big powerhouse of an economy. So look, we'll try and do this thing. And it is very domestic. You have to have, if I have understood it correctly, you have to have a domestic Chinese bank account as the on ramp and off ramp. So it's not too adventurous in there. But I absolutely see their strategic play on what they're doing. Now, of course, last week, President Biden issued some executive order on to his minions that they should go away and come up with policy recommendations in the next 6 months as to what they do or don't need, which is probably a good chance for the US, I think.
I think we'll all be watching that one closely. I think it's perhaps in closing, if I may, one more question. We've heard a lot about the distinction between perhaps, say, trusted intermediary or trusted protocol. Trusted intermediary being the route we've kind of been describing, which the West has taken to use banks and financial actors to intermediate the new technologies and handle the responsiveness for the system to engage with them. And I think trusted protocol could be perhaps the view that we've kind of danced around, saying is a decentralized finance, as in the code itself possible to with the use of smart contracts, for example, work through some of the problems and resolve them without necessarily there needing to be a finger to point. And I'd like to just draw this question then to money itself. And we've seen there's a lot of questions in the West around the use of cash, and the need to move to a cashless economy, perhaps for efficiency's sake. Do we think that the discussion around fiat currencies themselves is going to take a similar route as things digitize, and as we move to perhaps a trusted intermediary model more than the trusted protocol? And I would just be curious, do we think there's a future for fiat currency?
I think that the simple answer is yes. And I say that in a way that it says the means of payment, back to that earlier triangle that I've been, that needs to be a regulated liability. And I have to give some credit to a good old friend of mine and a very wise guy in the payments business, Tony McLaughlin at Citibank, who came up with this expression of regulated liabilities, and trying to set up a regulated liability network. And he's very much on the right path. Tomorrow he'll be speaking, I think, at the BIS, and this will be a topic. The soul of money is trust, as the current general manager of BIS, Augustine Costin, so well put it. And he was hitting on the idea that there should be sovereign money, because that deals with the trust and it's a regulated liability. I think you could throw the net wider. I think Tony at Citi is closer to it with this idea of there are regulated liabilities. So I think once we can get to that point that says, yeah, there are tokens, there are payment tokens, and they're regulated liabilities, whether they're created by Citibank or JP or what have you, that ups the comfort factor for everybody to use in that, and that seems to be, to me, the requirement for that means of payment. It's got to be a regulated liability, but hence my not being particularly kind about Tether earlier, and what they've done. And although, you know, those are fair observations on my part, will smart contracts rule the world? As a plumber, I tend to smile broadly when I hear this, and I get all these people spouting off, and you listen to them, and they go, and these smart contracts are going to be great. It's going to figure out that we've got interest payments to make and we've got maturity proceeds to pay. And I'm just sitting there laughing my head off, going, smart contract itself is not going to guarantee anything. smart contract will possibly guarantee that somebody is told a default 24 hours in advance of a coupon date or maturity date that the issuer needs to make the funds available. But no smart contract will a priori, just to keep the lawyers happy with some Latin, ensure that everybody gets paid. There are no guarantees. So I think this gets back to where you were heading earlier with some of the comments about the fintech stuff, that it's all shiny on the outside. When you get down to the nitty gritty, they are not, it's certainly not as shiny, even to the point where some people are just completely unaware of the necessity of some of those steps further down the chain that are in there. So I think we have to take all these claims about smart contracts being the be all and end all with a great big pinch of salt. They can certainly help define standards. They can certainly help automate processes, but a smart contract alone is no guarantee that an issuer will meet its obligations on coupon payment date or maturity, or that a dividend will get paid and the right amount of withholding will be taken from it. No, it won't happen. So I tend to smirk a little when I hear that, you know, smart contracts are the be all and end all. They're not.
I think they're also yet to be tested in stress events. And we're seeing a war going on right now, and people are looking into a lot of options contracts to see if there's Russia exposure, and it takes time to dig into that. I found this a particularly rich discussion. I think we've covered a lot of ground, running from custody to centralization to the challenges and risks of CBDCs and stablecoins. I just wanted to say a huge thank you for your time, Olaf. It's been a pleasure.
More than welcome, Sean. It's a delight. Just having the conversations gives the opportunity to just polish the thinking a little bit. So it's always good to have these invites. Yeah, let me think a little bit about this. Let me think a little bit about that. So thanks for providing that opportunity.
Fantastic. I look forward to the next. Just
have a great week.
Thanks for joining us. You've been listening to The Gauge, Green Gauge's monthly podcast series. Subscribe to the podcast to stay informed of all our upcoming shows and keep up to date with the latest blockchain and digital asset analysis and thinking.